Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call to order the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Glad to see everybody here today. The first order of business is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt. Hewitt. Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Backer.
Backer, present.
Bonner. Excused. Bierman.
Present.
Bolden.
Present.
Damoth. Damoth. Freiberg.
Present.
Grinhagen.
Present.
Heel.
Present.
Morrison.
Present.
Munson.
Present.
Fryer.
Present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott. Wolgamott. A quorum is present.
All right, thank you. And I see Representative Hewitt is here as well. And never fear, members. We know that technology is not perfect. And when we see you come in, we will note your presence. Thank you. So, Representative Bolden, would you move the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Thank you. So, Representative Bolden moves approval of the minutes of March 2nd. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, if you would unmute yourselves, members. The motion is to approve the minutes of March 2nd. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Thank you, Representative Bolden. So first,
Madam Chair, Damoth, yes. Present.
Oh, thank you, Representative
Madam Chair.
Damoth.
Thank you.
Okay. The first bill on the agenda is House File 1173. We have Representative Lippert here with us, and since he's not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 1173 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Lippert, you have an A1 amendment, which is a technical amendment, I understand?
That's correct. Yes, the A1 amendment keeps the existing notice requirements in place for most facilities covered by Section 144.555 and makes the new notice requirements and public hearing requirements only apply to hospitals. There was a mistake in the original draft of the bill.
Okay, well, let's adopt that, and then you can explain the bill as amended. So the chair will move the A1 author's amendment. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, if you would unmute yourselves again, members, all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Lippert, welcome, and please explain House File 1173 as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Every Minnesotan deserves access to the healthcare services they need and the basic hospital services they need. In the last few years, the closure of hospital campuses or the removal of basic hospital services from a campus has become an issue of increasing concern across the state. It's a concern in rural areas. It's a concern in our cities. This is a concern that impacts Minnesotans across geography and race. Since 2018, in just the last 2 years, the Fairview System closed Bethesda Hospital in St. Paul. The Fairview System closed the emergency department, the birth center, and other specialties at St. Joseph's in St. Paul. Earlier this year, there was news that the Fairview System might close 100 mental health beds at St. Joseph's in St. Paul as well. As I mentioned this possibility to law enforcement and EMS officials in Northfield and Rice County, they couldn't believe it. When patients in the Northfield Hospital need a mental health placement, it's common for patients to be transferred to Fargo, 280 miles or over 4 hours away because beds aren't available. The Allina system transferred the birth center at Unity Hospital in Fridley to Allina's Mercy Hospital in Coon Rapids. The Mayo Health System moved the birth center and surgical center from its hospital in Albert Lea to Mayo's hospital in Austin. And the Mayo Health System also closed its Springfield, Minnesota hospital last year. And that's just since 2018. These decisions are being made for business reasons, but they're decisions that impact the public. These decisions impact mothers going into labor, children and parents and seniors who need emergency care and only realize how important it is to have an emergency department close by when they're having an emergency. They impact families who have a loved one going through a mental health crisis and they're trying to hold their lives together. These closures impact healthcare workers and they impact communities. They create turmoil and confusion and reinforce the suspicion that what's driving decisions for hospital systems is profitability and positioning within a marketplace rather than the care that Minnesotans need. The public needs structures that can protect their access to essential hospital services. At the very least, the public should have ample notice and a forum where their voices can be heard in the event of the closing of a hospital campus or the curtailment of key services, and that's what this bill does. When a hospital closes a campus or curtails operations related to maternity care, newborn services, intensive care unit services, inpatient mental health services, or inpatient substance abuse treatment services, the hospital system must notify the Commissioner of Health 9 months before the scheduled curtailment of services. This is an increase from the 90-day requirement in current law. What's new in this bill is that the Commissioner of Health must also conduct a public hearing in the community where the closure or curtailment of services is taking place, at least 6 months before the scheduled change. The hearings will have a structure. Those making the decisions will need to explain their decision, how those in the service area of the hospital will be able to receive the services that have been moved or closed. Members of the public will have a chance to ask questions and to testify. Also, when a hospital closes the campus, the community has the right of first refusal for the facility. If the community wants to come together to maintain the lost services through that particular facility, they'll have the ability to do that. At this point, I'll turn to the testifiers who are with me today. And I believe the first is Cleveland Don Mazzal.
Thank you very much, Representative Lippert. I actually have first on my list, I have Sandy Anderson.
That's fine.
Is she one of your testifiers as well?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And it's okay, that the order is okay. I just want to make sure you get to do this in the way you wanted, Representative Lippert. Would you rather have Ms. Cleveland go first?
Ms. Anderson can go first. That's just
okay.
Fine.
Perfect. Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Anderson. Please introduce yourself for the record and tell us who you're with, and then please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Sandy Anderson. I'm a registered nurse at currently at St. John's Hospital in Maplewood and a member of Minnesota Nurses Association. Representative Lippert and members of the Health Finance and Policy Committee, my name is Sandy Anderson, and I'm a registered nurse who works at St. John's Hospital in downtown St. Paul. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Nurses Association, the labor union of over 22,000 dedicated RNs and other healthcare professionals in Minnesota, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Iowa. Until December of 2020, I worked on the 4,000 unit at St. Joseph's Hospital in downtown St. Paul. I am here today to speak in support of HF1173, a bill that would change the requirements for notification should a hospital close or shift a majority of its services to another site. We have had a seismic shift in healthcare in the Twin Cities. Patients at mHealth as well as children's hospitals are now scrambling to find care elsewhere. Changing the timeline for notification to the Department of Health from 90 days to 9 months will mean that patients have adequate notice that they will need to find care in other places. Adding a requirement for a public hearing will help ensure that the hospitals hear the voices of patients and community members and then take those voices into consideration when they are making their decisions about changes or closures. I have had some experiences with this as a nurse who has worked at various hospitals in the mHealth Fairview system. Beginning in late 2019, it was announced that mHealth Fairview would be reducing the number of beds at Bethesda Hospital to 50, down from 89. At that time, there was no announcements about the future of nearby St. Joe's. Fast forward to October of 2020, mHealth Fairview announced that it was closing Bethesda completely by the middle of November. and most of St. Joe's Hospital would be closing by the end of the year. Patients have been left scrambling, not just about how they could continue to access care in downtown St. Paul, but how their families could bring them to their care. Workers have been concerned about what would happen to their patients and, of course, their own jobs. MHealth Fairview has consistently attempted to hide their plans for healthcare in St. Paul, which caused the City Council to strongly oppose their actions by resolution. Executives with little to no ties to the community and those were the furthest away from actually providing direct care continue to refuse transparency in their efforts to strip healthcare accessibility from our communities. Community or worker input came only after a memo was leaked to the media about their plans and was quickly shelved when the COVID crisis began. Minnesotans should have access to safe care regardless of race, income, or neighborhood. As large hospital systems take over community hospitals and the bottom line drives decision-making, too many are left without access. This bill will allow patients, workers, and community members to ask questions and understand how the closure of a hospital or moving of services to another city or part of the metro area will impact their care. This longer timeline for notification and the requirement for a public hearing can help reveal how they plan to care for all their patients, especially people of color, people with mental health conditions, the elderly, and those with addictions. This bill is just one of many tools that can be used to stop the further corporatization of healthcare in Minnesota. And that's why I and the Minnesota Nurses Association urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nurse Anderson. We appreciate your testimony. Next on the list, I have Cleveland Donazel. I hope I'm saying it correctly. Welcome.
Chair, members of the community. My name is Cleveland Donazel. I live in Cottage Grove. I am on the executive board of the SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. Our union represents over 40,000 workers across the state. On their behalf, I am a supporter of HF 1173. For 28 years, I have worked at Bethesda. As you know, we were the first COVID union, first COVID hospital, excuse me. So therefore, when MHealth decided to shut down the hospital, no one told us. We had to learn it through the media. We need this bill. When the hospitals, as actually it hurts the community by closing hospital, the public at the very least deserve an opportunity to tell their story and show what it's going to do to community if they don't have it there. I want you to know that workers were, as you call it, dedicated to being at the COVID center. During the pandemic, we provided critical services at that time. MHealth didn't even consider to have a conversation with us about it. For me, I'm one of those that did work at the hospital who did lose their job. I'm one of those. MHealth made a decision without even contacting the public. The bill would have not stopped MHealth from closing Bethesda Hospital, but it would have at least forced them to do it during the daylight with everyone watching. I believe that if the community had more opportunity and the public to talk about the damage that were done, they would have at least likely to close the hospital or work to accommodate those that were harmed. Please support HF 1173. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, now we have Mary Krinke. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Krinke and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. I'm here today to express our concerns with House File 1173. Changes in healthcare services and delivery are inevitable and they're going on in every community in our state. There are three primary reasons why hospitals and health systems change services. Number one, patients, purchasers, and policymakers are all seeking to reduce the cost of healthcare. Number two, we cannot find adequate workforce, and particularly in some given service areas. And number three, innovations and advances in care are ever-changing, reducing the need for some services while increasing the need for other services and sometimes in different care settings. Last week, the American Hospital Association released an economic analysis
estimating that for calendar year 2021, hospital revenues will go down between $53 billion and $122 billion with a B. Minnesota is usually about 2% of the national market, which would put that at about $1 billion to $2.4 billion for Minnesota. These economics will drive change to find savings throughout the system. The bill calls for a nine-month delay if a hospital can no longer provide certain services. These could be due to many reasons, but primary amongst them is a lack of workforce. Several hospitals have had to make the difficult decision to no longer provide labor and delivery services. There's currently a nationwide discussion about best practices. When volumes of deliveries fall below a certain level, it's recommended that a hospital cease doing these procedures. This is primarily because of low volumes and safety concerns. Section 2 of the bill calls for a right of first refusal. The last thing a hospital board of directors wants to do is to close their local hospital. However, if this difficult decision is made and the hospital is now required to offer the hospital to the city or county, this will present significant challenges. How would the local unit of government really operate a hospital? The original challenges faced by the hospital or health system will still exist. So the community may best be served by an alternative. A couple of years ago, the Albany Hospital was facing some difficult financial times, and Catholic Health Initiatives made the decision to sell the hospital to CentraCare Services. CentraCare reopened the hospital as a clinic. Granted, that's not a hospital, but the community of Albany now has a great clinic with local services and a hospital not too far away. We have to think about innovation and change in healthcare with rising healthcare costs. In closing, hospitals and health systems want to provide the right care at the right time in the right setting. This is what's driving high quality as we seek lower costs in healthcare. We have to know that this means changes are going to happen throughout our healthcare system. And we know that change is sometimes difficult, but that is what is happening around the country. And this bill really won't stop that from happening. So we just need to think about how can we move forward. Thank you for this time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. We appreciate your testimony. So Representative Lippert, I haven't yet seen any member hands go up. So did you want to, okay, now I do, since I said that. So I will call on a couple of members, and then I will let Representative Lippert, well, we'll see what the questions are. And then at some point here, not too long, we're going to go to the other big amendment that we have. So Representative Grunhagen and then Bierman.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, this is a good discussion to have, Representative Lippert, but I find I identify with the Minnesota Hospital Association. You know, one of the things to understand is that low reimbursement of government programs is one of the driving forces of the closure of the of our medical hospitals and facilities. And the further we expand low reimbursement for government, the worse it's going to get. You know, you don't have to believe me. John Delaney, a presidential candidate for the DFL this last go-around, he stated in a primary debate that when he talked to the CEOs of his state, which I think are Ohio, that if they went to Medicare for all...
You know what, Representative Grunhagen, I'm sorry, but you're off topic here. We need to stick to the bill. We're not talking about Medicare for all. We're talking about House File 1173, if you would please confine your remarks to that.
Yeah, I'm getting to my question. The point is, the problem we're faced is not closing these hospitals because of financial reasons, like the Minnesota Hospital Association, Ms. Krinke stated, but it's the low reimbursement. So I think this is only going to make things worse. And Representative Lippert, how would your bill actually allow local communities to keep the services available? Who would pay for it? Where would the workforce come from? And how would this still keep it, who would pay for keeping these open when obviously for business reasons, they can no longer stay open.
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Grunhagen. And I appreciate your support for strong reimbursement rates. I also support making sure we have strong reimbursement rates. And I think, you know, the response to the workforce challenges is making sure that we're paying really strong wages to those who are providing our health care and those who are caring for us. I think those pieces are critically important. This bill responds to the situation with hospital closures by just making sure that we're having a conversation and that the public is being notified and can have a conversation with the providers about the services that are needed. And communities have been very upset about this, whether it's Albert Lea or people in St. Paul. And so we need to, at the very least, provide this opportunity for conversation. And I think it's a part of addressing the larger challenges that we're facing in healthcare to give people who feel like their care is threatened to have a voice in sharing what they really need.
Madam Chair, one comment?
A brief, Representative Grunhagen, thank you.
Yeah. I think the way to address the problem is not with this bill. It's to reinvigorate the private market, which has bailed out the losses on government programs for over 50 years. That's the solution. Your solution is only going to make things worse in the long run. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Bierman.
There we go, unmuted. Thanks for your patience. Madam Chair, Representative Lippert, I would like to join you and Representative Grunhagen in increasing those reimbursements for services at hospitals. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. I have a couple of questions. You mentioned all of those hospital changes since just 2018. It's quite a long list, and it's had quite an impact. And I'm just wondering if there has been any success on the public parties to extend or negotiate any of those changes that the hospital associations or the hospitals themselves went ahead with. Did they have any impact?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman. So to make sure I understand the question, could you just restate your question?
Sure. Have any of these closures resulted in an ability of communities to make an impact on the decisions of the hospitals to change services or make moves that you're aware of?
Representative Lippert.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman. Not that I'm aware of, and that's the genesis of this bill, that there's need for a conversation, that these changes happen very quickly, and more conversation is needed, more time to try to protect the needs of the public.
Madam Chair, if you would let me, I would like to ask a question of Ms. Krinke as well, please.
Sure.
This is in regards to, you had mentioned in your reasons that hospitals do close, and one of the questions I had was you had mentioned reduced or increase of services, and I'm wondering if you could comment on the fact that mental health services are in such need, beds for psych beds and so forth. They seem to be reducing everywhere. And so that's a service that we need an increase of. And I'm just wondering how the market is responding to that.
Thank you, Representative Bierman. And I'll just before she answers that, I'll just comment that the amendment we're going to move in just a few moments actually deals with that topic as well. So please go ahead, Ms. Krinke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Bierman. Just to give you one example of how services can still be provided without it being on an inpatient basis. So there's something called partial hospitalization, where individuals would come to the hospital and they would get mental health services throughout the day. And then they would be temporarily discharged back to a respite type of setting. And that does not count as an inpatient stay. And we have seen this model around the country. It has saved money, it saved mental health personnel, and it's just another model. So I think it's important that we look at the entirety of mental health services, not just inpatient bed days. That's
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Krinke, for that. I would like to talk with you further about that offline. I do have some concerns about these services when people are not admitted to the hospital, and I just want to go into depth with you on that at another time. But I have one more question, please, Madam Chair. It'll be quick. This is in regards to the option for the right of first refusal. You mentioned in your opening statement a hospital that had turned into a clinic and then had a hospital that people had to go to further away. So let me ask, what would be the problem with allowing that a community to develop a site to their liking, whether it's a community or a hospital? And I'd like to just hear more about why you would oppose that.
Ms. Krinke.
Madam Chair and Representative Bierman, the structure of the bill says that the right of first refusal is to the local unit of government, a city or a municipality. And so that really limits what a healthcare system might opt to do. And so I'm just pointing out that one option a health system or hospital might do is to recognize we can't stay a hospital, but maybe we can become a clinic and affiliate with a larger hospital not too far away. So I just wanna throw that in there, that there's other options that you can still provide services without being a licensed hospital.
Thank you.
Thank you. It sounds like maybe there's some room to tweak the bill, maybe to get the hospital association support, perhaps. Who knows? Representative Hewitt.
Madam Chair, I'm going to wait for the amendment. I'm sorry. Thank you.
All right. So very good. So Representative Lippert, I want to give you the final word on this, but I just want to say here that I am a huge supporter of this idea. And, you know, really the thrust of the bill, I get it that there might be some things that need to be worked out on the right of first refusal, but the thrust of the bill is to allow communities to find out what's going on, why these services are being removed, and to have some input. The bill does not give anybody the ability to stop the closure or to stop the changes in this first part of the bill. So I think it's entirely reasonable. You know, there's, in fact, it's really, other than perhaps the timing issue, which again, perhaps could be tweaked, maybe there could be exceptions for certain kinds of closures, or, you know, maybe there's work that could be done here. But the idea that the community, that there's some big harm in having the provider come to the community and say, if it's a workforce problem, you have a hearing and you say there's a workforce problem, we can't sustain the service. And then the community perhaps has an opportunity to be a partner in trying to solve that problem. Or if you say, you know, there's a cost issue, we're not able to, you know, sustain the services and make enough money, the community can perhaps be a partner, but at least to the community to know. And I think that's the thrust of the bill. So Representative Lippert, anyway, I'll give you the last word and then we'll move the amendment that Representative Fisher is here to talk about.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I thank the committee for their time. Yeah, I don't think we should be afraid of that conversation, and I think that conversation is necessary for communities to understand what's happening, and also for hospital systems to understand the needs of the community. And so I think this bill is a step forward, and I look forward to the rest of the conversation related to the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Lippert. So with that, the chair will move the amendment, which is the A3 amendment. And that is the language from House File 1528. And that is Representative Fisher's bill. So Representative Fisher is with us. And welcome, Representative Fisher, if you would care to introduce the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and committee, for the opportunity to be able to present the amendment. The basis of the amendment is because in our current system, it's unthinkable for somebody who has a broken leg to show up at the hospital and be sent home saying, oh, we don't have time to deal with it, or to sit in the emergency room for a day or 2 days before they receive any treatment at all for that broken leg. But yet our current mental health system is built on that situation where people are being brought in through the emergency room, a lot of times with other underlying conditions that require emergency room attention. They get the medical needs addressed, but the critical Mental health needs are not being addressed in the situation, and they're being told, go home, or they sit around without any treatment for the mental health issues for several days at a time. What this bill would do, what this amendment would do, is would allow several things to occur to change our current system. Our current system only allows licenses to be issued after going through a complex system of showing a need, coming to the legislature and getting legislative approval. We're finding out that right now that is not working. An example would be is if St. Joe's closes their hospital, Regents Hospital is willing to step up, but they have to go through a complex process to be able to have those, to have extra licenses to come over to them. So what this bill would do is change the system so the system will work to meet the needs and move the bed licenses to where they're needed. It would allow the commissioner to take a look at, are the beds that have been issued out there being used? And if not, allows a process to be set up so that unused beds for mental health or substance use issues could be taken back and reissued basically to other systems or hospitals who are willing to provide that service instead of going through the complicated process that we have right now. This would also be something that it would not have to go through the public process. It would shorten the time length and provide the opportunity to have better underlying outcomes as we go forward. This does not address all of the problems out there. I can tell you that right now in the current system that according to a report that came forward in our committee, in the entire state, there are 1,154 mental health beds that are currently in use. They typically operate at about 90% capacity. If St. Joe's decides to go ahead without the 100 beds that they're providing there, that's about 10% of the capacity right there. Fairview Systems has already let go 18 other beds in the West Metro. So we will become in a situation where right now we will have many more instances of people coming in and being told, oh, you know, it's terrible that you've got this mental health crisis, but, you know, we don't have any beds right now. You can sit around here, you can sit around at home, and maybe in a week or two we might have a bed. Or a very common one is we'll ship you off to another state. One of the things I hear from a lot of rural people is that it's not uncommon they have to transport people from the southwest corner of the state up to Fargo, North Dakota, taking critical service people, first responders, out of that community for 3 to 8 hours at a time as they transfer people to a hospital in another state that's got the capacity. So it seems we have some problems in the system here, and I think this is one of the ways that we can get at it is being able to make it easier for licensed beds to be put where they're needed within the community, and also hopefully that would get it from being so many concentrated in the metropolitan area here is being able to have the opportunity to get them out to the local communities throughout the rural parts of our state that need these services so they don't have to go so far to receive them. And I also have a testifier here that can also speak to the issue.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative Fisher. Ms. Afterholden, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Afterholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Our mental health system is not fully built, and we need more of everything, a wide array of community-based services and inpatient mental health beds. The Behavioral Health Division this year, earlier this year, heard from people with mental illnesses and families with children who waited for excessively long periods of time in an ER for a bed, and often were placed far away from home, even people from the metro area who had to travel to North Dakota. Only in mental health would people wait for hours, days, weeks in an ER for a hospital bed. I can't prove it, but I'm pretty sure that if we had people with heart problems waiting in the ER for this long, hospitals would be adding beds to their cardiac units. We have situations where hospitals went through the review process, promised to add mental health beds, and didn't. Most hospital systems now have to do a community mental health needs assessment and or community health needs assessment, and mental health is almost always in the top three categories of needs, but we're not meeting them. We've already had one mental health psych unit close in the metro area, and frankly, we can't afford to lose any more. So what we want to do is make it harder to close beds that are needed and make it easier to add beds that are needed. But we also make it clear that a psych hospital, where only mental health and substance use disorder treatment is provided, is a non-starter. First, our head is connected to the rest of our body, and when someone has an acute mental health need, we can't disconnect their head. Second, without an ER, you can decide who can come into your unit. And maybe it's only patients from your health system versus anyone who comes through an ER and needs inpatient site care. Third, Medicaid doesn't pay for what's called an IMD, an Institute for Mental Disease, where any hospital with over 16 beds where over half of the people are being treated for a mental illness or substance use disorder, that's what's called an IMD, and you can't use Medicaid. Well, we simply can't bill beds that can't actually bill Medicaid. And while increasing access to community services is needed, it'll be many years before we can say we don't need more hospital beds. And Ms. Krinke mentioned partial hospitalization, which is great, and we've actually had it for quite some time. But when someone is suicidal, they need 24-hour cares, not 4 to 5 hours. Someone who is psychotic or catatonic due to their psychosis, mm-hmm. they can't be sent home at night. We have cardiac rehab services in the community, but we aren't cutting inpatient cardiac care. I know that this isn't the only answer. We need to increase the inpatient rate for Medicaid. We need to address workforce shortages, but we also need to make it easy for hospitals to add beds without using their bank beds. I'll be honest, I don't know what to say to families anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to tell them mm-hmm. that their loved one needs inpatient care and they simply cannot get it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Honestly, that gives me chills. Thank you. Okay, so questions to the amendment, comments to the amendment from members. Right, not seeing any. So with that, okay, Representative Bierman.
I was just wondering, Madam Chair, I was hoping I could get Ms. Abderholden to comment on what the need looks like for those mental health beds in the state of Minnesota. How big of a shortage do we have presently, like before those 100 beds close? And where are we at, you know, as far as numbers? Is there any way you could give us kind of a target or what would be something that we should shoot for?
Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bierman. I mean, we've worked with some of the mental health providers, you know, in the psych units, and what they've told me is, we know we have enough beds when people aren't boarding in an ER. And certainly getting people to move out of the hospital beds when they're not needed, which was actually a bill that we took up earlier today, will certainly help with that flow. But right now, I would guess that we need at least another 100 beds. And if we lose these 100, we'll be in the hole at least 200.
Representative Bierman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's all for now. Thanks.
All right. And then Representative Hewitt, did you still want to speak to this amendment?
Oh. Madam Chair, I just have a couple of quick questions. And
please.
And it goes under the Ms. Abderholder, I'm sorry if I said your name wrong. Do you have an average what it actually cost or what is reimbursed on an average night stay for a mental health patient?
Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. You know, I had been looking at those figures just a month ago, and I believe it's about, let me look it up, but it's certainly not, Medicaid doesn't pay 100% of the cost, that's for sure. And it's short by several thousand dollars. But I can get those exact numbers because now, as you know, hospitals have to post that information, so I've been looking at their websites.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
And Ms. Krinke, do you have any statistics on that of what the ballpark, the amount that is reimbursed?
Ms. Krinke?
Madam Chair and Representative Hewitt, every couple years we have what's called rebasing at the state of Minnesota, and the state has analysis of how much Medicaid pays below costs, and it's at about, they pay about 70% of the Medicaid dollar, so about 30% below the cost for the Medicaid program. As Abderholden just said, we are just starting to look at the new information that is now required to be posted under CMS that gets at what the commercial payers are paying. So I don't have a great answer for your question, what is the percentage that is paid on mental health beds. So
And Ms. Krinke, is that cost or charges?
The new information from CMS is what the commercial plans are paying by service line. It does not have what the costs are. It has what the payments are by commercial payment line.
Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hewitt.
One last statement, then I'll be done. And I would like to get those numbers back. So if both of you could send them to me, that would be great. And I'll share them with the committee. I'm one of the providers probably recently, as little as 2 years ago, that sat in the ER overnight with many people that were suffering from a crisis. And the sad news was is that I would go home for 3 days and come back and those same patients would be in the ER and still sitting there, which is no place for somebody suffering from a crisis. I'm also one of those people that drove hours over the road with adolescent children to different parts of the state and separating them from their families. Representative Fisher, Chair Fisher, this is a great bill, and I'm glad you're addressing it, and I'm glad that the House has decided that this should be at the forefront, because we're not going to help these people by, and I get it, the hospitals have to do what they have to do, but we need to come up with a solution. And I heard last week that even another system is starting to close down its home-based beds, and this is very upsetting because we need beds, we need this, or we just, what are we doing here? So thank you, Madam Chair, for listening to me here.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, my question is for Representative Ms. Aberholy, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But, you know, I hear from my county and my sheriff's department that our county jails are holding many mental illness patients because there's no room for beds also. Would you agree with that statement, or what are your thoughts?
Ms. Afterholden.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen. Yes, we have people with mental illnesses in our jails who are brought there because there isn't anywhere else for them to go, and they wanted to keep them safe. It's not a good place, frankly, for someone, and it is a waste of resources on top of that.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, members, just remember, a lot of this is brought on by the expansion of government healthcare and the low reimbursement. We've got to reinvigorate the private market. That's the solution to higher reimbursement to our medical facilities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Okay, I'm not seeing any other member questions. So we're ready to vote on the amendment. So with that, I'm going to renew my motion that on the A3 amendment, which is House File 15, it's the amendment is the language of House File 1529. So, let's see. So, if members, if you would unmute yourselves, this is a voice vote. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed?
Aye.
No.
The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And with that, members, we're going to lay over House File 1173 as amended for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And, you know, just so everybody understands, this is a process that allows for continued dialogue. So I would really encourage that if there are ways that the two parts can be tweaked to make them more workable, to, you know, to get support from people we'd like to have support from, we would love to know. So thank you very much, members. Thank you, Representative Lippert and Representative Fisher. Okay, so the next bill on the agenda is House File 834, and that is Representative Herr. Welcome to the committee, Representative Herr. Since you are not on the committee, the chair will move that House File 834 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. And Representative Herr, please go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Health, Finance, and Policy Committee members for hearing House File 834. House File 834 is an exemption to the hospital construction moratorium that would allow Regents Hospital in St. Paul to increase its inpatient bed capacity by 45 beds. This is important because Regents is a SafeNet hospital and the top charity care provider for the East Metro and Ramsey County, which is the most densely populated and racially diverse county in Minnesota. We need Regents Hospital to have the ability to expand to meet the growing needs of the East Metro community, and we have a testifier here today who can speak to that in more detail.
All right. Thank you, Representative Herr. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Megan Remark, and I'm the president of Regents Hospital. Thank you, Representative Herr, and to all of the co-authors of this bill. I also want to take a moment to thank the legislature for the support that you have provided hospitals during this pandemic. It has been greatly, greatly appreciated. As Representative Herr said, Regents Hospital is the only level one adult and pediatric trauma and burn center in the East Metro, and we care for many patients that cannot be treated in other hospitals. Regents Hospital is also unique amongst large hospitals in Minnesota in that we use nearly all of our bed license capacity for patient care. Most other large hospitals have excess bed licenses, giving them the flexibility to expand without having to go through the legislative process. In 2017, Regents Hospital's occupancy levels were higher than optimal, and we requested through the public interest review process to be granted an exemption to the state's hospital bed moratorium. We were grateful that the legislature granted us 55 new bed licenses at that time, with 15 of those bed licenses designated for mental health. We will have all of those 55 bed licenses, including the 15 designated for mental health, in use by the end of this year, 2021. This current proposal authorizes an additional 45 beds to meet future patient care needs. We plan to use 5 of those 45 beds for mental health, making Regents Hospital the largest provider of inpatient mental health services in the East Metro with a total of 120 beds. Here are some data points that illustrate the need for additional beds. In 2019, Regents operated at an average occupancy level of 87% for inpatient, general medical and surgical beds, and 94% for mental health beds. The national average for hospital occupancy is approximately 66%. In 2019, due to capacity constraints, our emergency department had to go on divert status 161 times, meaning that patients had to be diverted to other hospitals in the metro and sometimes beyond the metro. Adding inpatient capacity is a significant investment of hospital resources that we do not undertake lightly. We are not aware of any opposition to this bill, and we have the support of Ramsey County, AFSCME and SEIU Healthcare, the St. Paul Area Chamber of Commerce, and the Minnesota Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Thank you for consideration, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Remark. Are there questions from members? Representative Biermuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing the bill forward. I do have a question for Ms. Remark, just a question on the bed utilization. What's the process if you, over time, need to change the utilizations? Let's say you needed more beds for mental health or had increases in other areas. Is there a process for that?
Ms. Remark.
So let me see if I understand your question right. Could you repeat it again for me?
Sure. Madam Chair, the question was, let's just say those 5 beds you mentioned for dedicated for additional mental health. Question was, can you use those beds or reutilize the type of use for the beds, increase mental health beds as needed or in other areas as well?
Ms. Remark.
Oh, thank you, Representative Liebling. Thank you for your question, Representative Bierman. Typically, the PIR process does not specify the specific type of use. So when the bed licenses that hospitals have, we have the flexibility to use those beds for whatever purpose meets the demand that we have for services. Now, having said that, we have specific facilities designed to take care of inpatient mental health and specific facilities designed to take care of patients who need medical care. So a bed is not a bed from that perspective because the surrounding facility needs to match what the patient's needs are. Depending, for example, in mental health, we have locked mental health units for the safety of our patients, and we have different types of rooms than what we need when we're taking care of trauma patients. So it is, it's a quite complex process, but we are able to have the flexibility. For example, we added OB-GYN beds as part of our 55. We also added medical beds, and we also added mental health beds as a part of the 55 bed licenses we were granted in 2018.
Representative Bierman, anything further?
No, Madam Chair, that helped a great deal, just that flexibility over time. And I understand what you're saying as far as departments and setup, that you would need to make major renovations to change quantities of beds. I just wanted to be sure about the ability to do so as time goes forward. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for the testifier, I heard you say the number of times you all were on diversion. I'm wondering if you have keep data on or have a way of knowing how many patients were diverted during those times?
Ms. Remark?
That is a very good question. Thank you, Representative Bolden. So how divert works is when either our emergency department or our inpatient hospital does not have capacity to take another patient, we indicate that we are not able to take ambulances. So that number is actually a low estimate because it just estimates the number of times we have gone on divert. But once we go on divert, we could divert 4 or 5 or 10 patients during the amount of time we're on divert, and we would have no way of knowing how many people we've turned away. The other thing I would say is that going on divert is only applied to receiving ambulances. All hospitals are required, if anyone simply walks in the door, that we need to figure out how to take care of them. And so know that we continue to operate at a very high occupancy, recognizing that people will still come in if they walk in or drive into a hospital facility. And we don't divert trauma or burn as part of our commitment to being the level one trauma hospital.
Representative Bolden, anything further? Okay, so I have a few questions as well. And so first of all, I wonder if I know that Ms. Remark, you've talked about the diversions and the high capacity, and I'm aware that in Minnesota, most of our hospitals actually were run at pretty high occupancy most of the time. And you gave the figure, I think you said 67% is the national average, and that seems much lower than what we do in Minnesota generally. So the question that I have is sort of about what is prompting this request at this time and what the number, you know, where do you get that number from? So if you could just talk a bit more, in particular, we just had a big discussion about hospital closures and a potential closure of 100 mental health beds in the general area and the closure of an emergency room. And I think that we as a committee really want to understand how this request fits in with all of that. Or is it just something you would have needed anyway? Because if you needed this anyway, then I think we're even more concerned that we're going to be left with nowhere for patients to go when these, you know, if we have more closures. So could you just, you know, give us a bit more discussion about that, if you would?
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative Liebling. A couple of things. One is that when we first approached the legislature in 2018, we had done a significant amount of analysis on what we thought our bed need would be based on community demand over the next several years, like 10 years. And so when we came to the legislature in 2018, our request was for 100 hospital beds. We were able to achieve being granted 55 of those beds, which we actually thought would hold us for a period of time. Now that we're sitting in 2021, by the end of 2021, so less than 3 years from the time we were authorized those beds, we will have opened all 55 of those beds, including opening the 15 mental health beds that were required in 2018. So the reason for our ask this year is because by year end 2021, we will have all 509 bed licenses in use at Regents Hospital and operating at an average occupancy of 88%. So without the additional 45 beds, we're going to have trouble being able to continue to accommodate the needs in the East Metro.
Okay, thank you for that. And Representative Hewitt, I have another one, but I'll let you go first, and then I'll ask my final question. Representative Hewitt.
I would hate to go on top of the chair, Madam Chair.
So no, please.
I'll go ahead and ask. Again, I forgot the testifier's name, but I just want to ask her quickly. I'm familiar quite a bit with your hospital. And what are you looking like in your emergency room right now as far as, I know that there's patients that you keep 24 hours sometimes in an area. I don't know if that's true anymore, but I realize that. And how many can't you get to the floors because you're at capacity and you're running into this over and over again? And I know this is a bad year to ask that question because of what we've been living through, but I think you can give me a good idea of where it was before this, and then does that just keep going up?
You cut out on us a little bit, Representative Hewitt. You said where, and then we lost a few words. Give us an idea. She wanted to give an idea of where.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry. I'm going to broadband Rosemount someday. The question I have is the ER's 24-hour unit. You have a unit that, not part of it, I guess, is that you keep patients down there as long as you can, or use it as overflow until you can send them to the floor. How full, how many times is that unit full until right now, and is that factor into this?
Ms. Remark.
Thank you for your question, Representative Hoyt. So when we talk about our emergency department, we take care of both medical and mental health patients there. And I would say that our ER, when our ER is full, that is one of the indicators to go on divert. So that was 161 episodes when we went on divert. Have to do with one of two factors. One is either our emergency department is seeing a surge in patients of any kind, or that our ER is not able to move patients out of the ER because we do not have an inpatient bed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hewitt.
One last comment. I worked there in 1987 till 1990. We went on divert three times during that time. Times have changed, so it's time to change again. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Appreciate that. And then I'll just ask one more quick question, and then we're going to move on to the next bill. But this bill specifically exempts you from the public interest review. And we do, just so members know, normally when we do an exception, there's a request for exception to the bed moratorium, the Department of Health is asked to do a review to give us a report to tell us whether the request is in the public interest, basically. And they do quite a bit of analysis. And in this particular case, we do understand that I had understood that the need arose rather quickly, and so there wasn't time for the public interest review. But since the bill specifically exempts that, I'd like to kind of ask about that timeline and about whether Regents has had any discussion with the Department of Health, even though, without trying to have the full public interest review. Just because the bill asks for it doesn't mean that we don't, or exempts it, doesn't mean that the legislature wouldn't like to have some input. So I want to discuss that just for a moment. Ms. Remark?
Okay. Well, thank you for your question, Representative Liebling. The department, we have had conversations with the Department of Health, and the Department of Health does not have any opposition to this bill. The reason we are asking for 45 is it is a request for the balance of the original 100 that came out of the public interest review process in 2018. So it's consistent with our past analysis of the bed licenses we believed we would need. And because we have advanced sooner than we thought, bringing online the inpatient mental health beds, that's what also contributes to leaving us in a situation where by year end, we will not have any bed licenses remaining and have no flexibility to make any additional changes without this legislature's approval.
All right. Well, thank you for that. So I take from that that we could go back to that previous review and get some basic information. It's there and it's still applicable. All right. Well, thank you very much for being here today. Thank you, Representative Herr. With that, we will lay over House File 834 for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Appreciate your testimony. Now we're going to turn to House File 1609, which I'm the chief author of, and this bill comes from Hennepin County Medical Center, and so I'm going to just call on Jennifer DeCubelis, who's here for Hennepin Healthcare, and she's going to, I hope, explain this bill, which is a little bit complicated. And Ms. DeCubelis, I think this honestly fits in rather well with the discussion we've been having and some of the questions about reimbursement. And I'm just so glad we scheduled it this way, because I think this will really be instructive for members about how some of this works. So please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. As referenced, my name is Jennifer DeCubelis. I am the CEO for Hennepin Healthcare System. And Madam Chair, I agree with you. The dialogue I've heard really does portray the concern that we are bringing forward today, as well as the opportunity we see. Hennepin Healthcare, as you all know, plays a critical role in the healthcare of Minnesotans, and in particular, a significant role for individuals on Medicaid. We saw that repeatedly play out in 2020, with our role in responding to COVID-19 and to trauma across the state. We're here today to make sure that this essential state resource has a sustainable reimbursement structure.
And Ms. DeCubelis, sorry to interrupt you.
Yep.
But I did not move the bill. And most importantly, we have a DE amendment that we probably should move and adopt before we let you get too much further. So I'm sorry about that, my fault.
No worries.
So I will move House File 1609 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill, but I also have a DE1 amendment that's been distributed, and I would like to move the DE1 amendment. And let me just say to members, I would appreciate your adopting this so we can discuss it in its proper form, because this is actually a very technically complicated bill, and there's been a lot of work by Hennepin Healthcare and DHS on this. So the current form of the bill is in the DE. So if you would unmute yourselves, members, and I would just ask you all in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So now, I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Ms. DeCubelis, but now we have the real bill in front of us, so please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we want to make sure we get this one right. It's critical for us. So as I was saying, Hennepin Healthcare provides a critical role, and we saw that repeatedly played out in 2020 with our role in responding to COVID-19 and the trauma that we saw last summer across the state. So we're here today to make sure that the essential state resource has a sustainable reimbursement structure. And as Chair Liebling mentioned, it is complex, so I'm going to go through the bill a little bit, and if you'll bear with me on a little bit of time. But without this legislation today, Hennepin Healthcare will be forced to make dramatic reductions to our services, significantly impacting individuals with low income and communities of color. The change we're asking for today, in its simplest form to describe, directs DHS of Human Services to request CMS authorization of a Medicaid-directed payment specifically to our health system. This would replace some of our current supplemental payments and better align with federal policy at a projected no net cost to the state. As referenced, this bill is complex. The complexity speaks to the patchwork of financing at the federal level a safety net health system must access in order to provide services. CMS has recognized this complexity and the need for supplemental payments for health systems that serve a majority of Medicaid patients, such as Hennepin Healthcare. That's why these Medicaid-directed payments require greater transparency than current payments, and they ensure that the payments align with the state's quality goals. Our focus is best outcomes, best value for Minnesota's public programs. I'm going to briefly go over the details, and I'll go a little bit out of order just because of the flow. But if you reference in the bill, sections 3 and 4 lay out the details of how a new Medicaid-directed payment arrangement would be established and implemented, including the eligibility and the quality metrics that we would need to follow. Section 2 of the amendment is needed to end Hennepin Healthcare's current Medicaid fee-for-service supplemental pass-through. It would end the payment early. It's set to expire in a few years anyway, but it would end it July 1st of 2021 so that there wouldn't be overlap in these payments. You go back to Section 1. Due to the changes in the supplemental payments, DHS recommended this change to prevent any unintended consequences as it relates to our disproportionate share hospital payment, otherwise referenced as a DSH payment. This moves our DSH payment to the fee-for-service base rate adjuster, and DHS can explain this if necessary about how that process works, but we believe it would be administratively simpler for DHS to implement as well as potentially create some other efficiencies. And then the next section, Section 5, follows current law and exempts the intergovernmental transfer we will use as the state match from the provider tax. Our IGT, intergovernmental transfer, payments are already exempt from this tax. This was passed by the legislature just a few years ago. So this is not a change regarding the provider tax. We will continue to pay the provider tax on medical services as we always have. The MCOs as well, the managed care organizations, will pay the surcharge and the premium tax as they do today. There has been some confusion, so I want to be really clear on this language. This language does not exempt us from paying the provider tax and was never intended to do so. So that's a quick overview of the language. And basically what it does is it will provide a sustainable funding source for us versus fading out those supplemental payments as your significant public safety net health system. So I'm going to cover a little bit about why us, why Hennepin Healthcare. Hennepin Healthcare includes Hennepin County Medical Center, otherwise known as HCMC, which is a nationally recognized level one trauma center. And to note, we are at the top 1% for the lowest mortality rates in the nation. We serve Minnesotans across the entire state for trauma and are a critical Minnesota resource. In addition, we operate an expansive specialty and primary care clinic system across Hennepin County. And though it's based in Hennepin County, the health system serves all of Minnesota. We're far-reaching for our addiction services, for traumatic brain injury, for mental health, for burn care, the list goes on. And we train nearly half of the doctors in the state of Minnesota. We're home to an award-winning research institute. We're home to the Minnesota Poison Center. We have a 24/7 hyperbaric medicine chamber and much more. Can't emphasize enough how much Minnesota relies on us during times of greatest need and for care to prevent acute episodes. About 20% of our patients live outside of Hennepin County. One of the handouts in your packet shows a bar graph comparing our patients to the broader Minnesota Medicaid population statewide. And as you can see, complex care, those needing assistance removing barriers to wellness are disproportionately seen at Hennepin Healthcare. About 45% of our revenue comes from Medicaid, far exceeding other systems. And Hennepin Healthcare serves a large number of patients who experience greater social and medical complexities, including substance use disorder, homelessness, serious mental illness, HIV, those disproportionately impacted by a higher disease burden, and other barriers that make life and wellness more challenging.
Okay. Ms. DeCabellis, we're a little short on time, so I'm going to kind of stop you, and I'd like to really bring us back to the bill. And thank you for that. And there are members, you have in your packets some materials from Hennepin Health that with some of the things that Ms. DeCabellis is talking about. And, you know, we do appreciate what Hennepin Health is doing, and that's why we're here working on the bill. So I just want to bring us back because we need to wrap up, and we do have one more bill. So before we go to questions, and I know that how this is working is complicated, but what it does illustrate, I think, for members, and I, you know, we've had a little bit of discussion about low reimbursements. And I just want to point out that there are things that are going on in our reimbursement system other than what members may think about when we talk about this. So we talk about a low rate that is paid by Medicaid, right? But as we know, fee-for-service is different than what MCOs may pay. But we also have these other revenue flows, which is what is being, not for everybody, mind you, but this is what is how a hospital like Hennepin County Medical Center is able to survive when it gets 40% of its patients are this low reimbursement. Okay, and it's over the years in my career, I've seen various ways that we try to draw down federal money, and it is very complicated. But and just correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. DeCabellis, just as a background for this bill, part of what's going on here is federal changes that make this new thing possible and make the old one less and less sustainable. So with this, the feds have changed the reimbursement, and that's why, or they've changed the opportunities for these supplemental payments, and that's why this is being done to try to take advantage of the new opportunity. Is that a good way to put it, Ms. DeCabellis?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Over 30 states have leveraged this new payment structure.
All right, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, I know we're short on time. I just wanna thank Hennepin County for what they're doing. I am a co-author on this bill, Chair Liebling. So you and I are getting closer all the time. It might scare both of us, just kidding. But I think this is good. This definitely brings out, I appreciated the testimony that this doesn't cost the state anything additional, but what amount of increase in medical payments on average will this bring to you? I mean, is it about a 20% increase over what you're currently receiving, 30%? Just on average, how much better will you do under this plan?
Ms. DeCabellis.
Representative, that's a great question, but hard to answer until we get into the detail with the Department of Human Services. But we do believe it will stabilize us. So that 10% reduction that we have to make across the system if this doesn't advance, we do believe it will close that gap.
Okay. Well, I certainly would be supportive. And I just, you know, I've had constituents in my area that have utilized Hennepin County Medical Center, and you serve the low-income Medicaid people, and you're definitely a critical part of our healthcare system here, so I urge members to support this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. It's good to hear you say that, and you've been saying that about us agreeing as long as I've known you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. I'll be brief. I just wanted to speak in support of this bill. You know, Hennepin County Medical Center does extraordinary work for some very vulnerable populations. Without them, I don't know quite candidly what we would do. And I know that the care and concern that the staff at Hennepin shows for that population is extraordinary. And you know, to be able to utilize a service, one, that does not, of course, cost the state money, but really allows us to keep intact that safety net for this population who desperately needs it, is really important. And just to tout their horn briefly, I just wanted to mention that what a lot of people don't know is because they are a Trauma One center, when we had the vice president in town with all of his heart concerns, if anything would have happened to him upon his visit, he would have been sent to HCMC, to their cardiac unit for care. That is how extraordinary this facility is. They take care of the most lowly to the most high among us, and they do it with a smile. So thank you for all of your hard work.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Bonner. And thank you, Ms. DeCabellis. And House File 1609, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. So thank you. Thank you, everybody. We're going to now take up House File 1531. Chair Lee is here to present the bill, and he is going to move. I'm going to move on his behalf that House File 1531 be laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Welcome, Chair Lee. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 1531. This bill will create a pilot program to address trauma and underlying cause and result of gun violence. Gun violence takes different form in different parts of our state, but often results from the same cause, which is trauma. Research has shown that perpetrators of gun violence are often victims of gun violence themselves, or have experienced forms of gun-related trauma. This bill creates a pilot program to address gun violence-related trauma by providing training, resources, education, and education to individuals, organizations, and the wider community. Just a summary of the bill directs the Commissioner of Health to establish this pilot program to aid in the reduction of trauma resulting from gun violence and to address the root causes of gun violence. The pilot program will make resources available to professionals and organizations who work with victims, witnesses, or perpetrators of gun violence occurring in a community, domestic, or other settings. These resources include training and recognizing trauma as both a cause and effect of gun violence, skill development for practitioners, and investment in community-based organizations that provide these services, replication and expansions of successful community-based violence prevention initiatives. And the pilot program will address the traumatic effects of gun violence exposure holistically, and materials are required to be prepared in multiple languages for those that speak English as a second language. Advisory panel will be formed to develop the protocol and programs for the guidelines that I am proposing, and a report is required for the pilot program to the Committee of Health and Public Safety. And we're proposing $100,000 in fiscal year 2022 from the general fund for this purpose. And members, you know, really, this is an issue that I wanted to bring forth because of, you know, some of the gun violence that I have seen in my community. And you're just engaging with my community members and talking about how, you know, even though we're not directly victims of gun violence, just having to go through that or see some of these scenes or whatnot in our community really is traumatizing. And having conversation with neighbors, you know, in the back of the alley of my house, and, you know, just bringing up this conversation of, are you getting help? And even talking to all of you today, I am getting goosebumps, and it's making me, you know, stress out and have a little bit of anxiety. And so I just want to let you all know that this is something that is serious and that we should consider having the Department of Health take a look at this. And I thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to present this. And I will now move over to my testifiers.
Thank you very much, Chair Lee. We appreciate it. Iolanda Evans-Mack, welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lee, and committee members. My name is Iolanda Evans-Mack. I'm the Director of Community Response and Education for Protect Minnesota and also the co-founder of Black Family Blueprint. Gun violence, as we know, is a public health issue. And so the establishment of this bill, a trauma-informed gun violence prevention pilot program, will help meet the community needs, especially the communities within the Twin Cities who are most frequently exposed to gun violence. It will also help prevent further gun violence by addressing the impact on those who have survived it. Trauma is both a cause and an effect of gun violence. And research shows that early and direct exposure to violence is the best predictor of whether an individual would later engage in gun-related crimes. Gun violence is a multifaceted challenge. It demands a holistic set of solutions to stop the cycles of daily gun violence in under-resourced communities. One of those being adequately and sustainably funding community-based, trauma-informed, and healing-centered violence prevention efforts, which will build authentic relationships relationships with communities, address those root causes, support community-based organizations, and then also build on the skill development of professionals and practitioners in the field that they may lead with holistic and trauma-informed lens. I'm a homeowner in North Minneapolis. I live here with my husband and two young children, and I tell you, it really breaks my heart to see the fear in my children when we hear the familiar pop, pop, pop in our community, the questioning if it was fireworks or if it was gunshots, and to see the mounting trauma inside of my children's young brains and wondering if I can save them from either end of the gun. But the issue of gun violence is not a Minneapolis problem. It's not a St. Paul problem. It truly is a problem in the state of Minnesota. This is a broad Minnesota problem that we're mentioning. And so we have to talk about the resources and action that's required to reduce gun violence in our communities. And just to mention, studies have found that harsh penalties for gun crimes, they have no deterrent effect and they do not decrease firearm crime. Minnesota needs new solutions to prevent gun violence. And so this bill is, in my professional opinion, a step in the right direction for individuals, families, and communities living within the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Evans-Mack. You are so correct. This is not just a Minneapolis and St. Paul problem. We just saw this in Buffalo, Minnesota. And of course, we've seen it elsewhere as well. So thank you so much. Next testifier, Roxanne O'Brien. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Hi, everybody. My name is Roxanne O'Brien, and like Fuli, I'm feeling a lot right now because I want to say facts. I want to tell you personal stories, and I know I only have like 2 minutes. But I did want to just bring, since this conversation also followed a really important conversation around mental health, I did just want to add that I had found an article that last year's theme for Mental Health Month was greater investment and greater access. And something relevant to add that I think is relevant to gun violence is the pandemic. Out of the article, the pandemic and the issuing uncertainty and economic instability have not only led to a spike in the number of mental health cases across the country, but also have exposed the inadequacy of our healthcare system's crisis readiness in tackling a surge in mental health cases. If we do not address the problem now, we are looking at a mental health epidemic down the road, one we are woefully under-equipped to fight, unless there's an investment push in government-backed awareness programs to destigmatize mental health problems, people are not going to come out and talk about it out in the open. One factor is that the mental health problems, we cannot expect to make headway in spreading awareness about mental health problems when the budgetary allocation for mental health is just 0.05% of the total healthcare budget. In a country with a population over 12 million, and then with just one psychiatrist for over 13,000 people, most mental health professionals shoulder an excess caseload without any institutional support. So as we think about investment with beds, we also have to think about adding more mental health professionals.
Well, thank you, Ms. O'Brien. I have to ask you to wrap up, but you've been addressing something that really isn't this bill. Did you want to say something in addition about this bill in particular?
Well, I would like to say that it is relevant because mental health issues are impacted by violence. And I live in North Minneapolis, and sometimes violence is, it's in many ways. So when you have when you have policy that's also violent, you also have people who are so stressed out that we end up taking it out on each other. So I would like to say that my personal story is that last year, right after his 17th birthday or right a week before his 17th birthday, he went into psychosis from from just a lot of the stress in the neighborhood, from being around friends who are affiliated, and friends who are, they feel the violence and the trauma from officers, from gun violence from them, and they feel the violence and the trauma from gun violence just happening too often. And I want to say that what my son went through was really hard. You may not look at a taser like a gun, but it's shaped like a gun. And when he went to the hospital for mental health support, he was tased in his back twice, and he wasn't a violent kid. So some people may think it's not connected, and I know you want me to stay on topic, but I will say that it is connected. And I will say that every other night we're hearing gunshots. And it's hard as an organizer and as an activist. It's hard to sit here and talk to you about policy when this is our lives.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you so much, Ms. O'Brien. We really do appreciate you being here and being part of the conversation. Representative Ryer has a question or comment. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Lee, for bringing this bill forward. I want to speak on behalf of it as a strong supporter of it, and I'll just tell you a little why. I mean, to me, I look at the way forward is for us to really understand root causes. And when Ms. Evans-Max spoke about trauma as a root cause, that resonates with me. The trauma from gun violence affects people's health. The stress of trauma leads to chronic health conditions. It leads to inability to perform in school. I mean, who in this room could learn when you've been living through the type of gun trauma that has been described so eloquently here today? And so because we are looking for ways to get at the root of issues, to me, this is just the smallest possible investment in something that is deeply, deeply important. And I thank you again for bringing it forward.
All right. Thank you very much. And I just want to check, Chair Lee, there was no amendment for this bill, was there?
No, Madam Chair. We don't have any amendment for this
bill. Okay. Just checking. All right. Well, Chair Lee, do you want to have the final word here and before we lay the bill over?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members for having discussions. And I just want to say thank you to both Ms. Evans and Ms. O'Brien for, you know, talking about their experience in this work around this. And just ask members to consider, you know, when you come up with the health budget, the impact that this is going to have or is already having on our community, some of the most vulnerable communities out there that we at the legislature try to help out every single day. And Madam Chair, I just want to say I'm thankful for this opportunity and look forward to this ongoing conversation.
Thank you so much, Chair Lee, for bringing this. And to our two testifiers, really deeply appreciate it. I must say I have chills too. And I bet that many of our members do. This has really been very moving and impactful hearing on a bill. So thank you very much for bringing this to us. And with that, House File 531 is laid over for possible inclusion in the finance bill. Thank you. So members, we are meeting on Friday, I'm sorry to say, 3 to 4:30 right now. It's possible that meeting might even extend a little bit. We will let you know as soon as we know. And we have quite a number of big bills on the agenda. So check your agenda. I won't go through it all right now, but appreciate everybody's attention today. We've heard some pretty big stuff, I think. And thank you very much. And we are adjourned.